how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
To infinity and beyond.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking, don't they?
It's classified.
You talking to me?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
I can't lie!
Expecto Patronum!
Entertainment X.
You never know what you're gonna get.
For this episode, I sit down with Rory McGregor. Rory has been directing some wonderful projects here in the city, and we talk about all of them. We focus on the beginning of his directing career and the little moments and actions he took that changed the trajectory of his career up into this point. So I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did having the conversation with Rory. Enjoy. We're back. I'm Clayton Howe, and today with me is Rory McGregor. Rory, thank you for chatting with me today.
Hey, I'm a pleasure.
So we met through some mutual friends.
We did. Yeah.
Chilling up in the Heights.
Yeah.
Which is always so much fun because you never know who you're going to meet on someone's couch.
Yeah, it's someone's living so room. Weird. I've been up there for 5 years now, which is very, really weird. I can't believe I've been in this country for 5 years. That's mad. But yeah.
So you've been at that in the same location up there, roughly?
No, I've had the most... I'm just going to tell everyone where I live, but... I've lived in the same sort of 10 blocks for 5 years, which is mad. I sort of started at 151, moved down to 144, you know, getting a little bit experimental, a little bit crazy, and
hello,
then up to 156, you know. So I've literally just done the same, sort of 10-ish blocks for the whole time I've been here. I should probably branch out, go to Brooklyn or something.
Yeah, the story is great.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, no. Nah. Maybe not for you.
I don't know. I haven't actually, I haven't spent much time in Queens, but.
There's some legendary diners out there. Okay. On to the topics of the day. Are you willing, if you're willing, to share the story of how you ended up in the Heights?
oh, God, it makes it sound so much more interesting than it is. No. So basically, yeah, I sort of had a weird upbringing. I was born in London and then my parents sort of worked in the tourism industry. So I ended up moving to Portugal when I was 12. And then sort of lived in Portugal for 6 years. And there's no, I mean, obviously when you sort of go, I lived in an area called the Algarve, which is sort of like a, I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like a very touristy area. Lots of sort of British people live there or go on holiday there. There isn't a huge theatre scene there. So I didn't really see an awful lot of theatre. In my school, I went to a very small school, so there wasn't many particularly sort of talented actors, so I ended up sort of taking a lot of the major roles and thought I wanted to be an actor. And then one day I was sort of in this English literature class, and I was studying A Clockwork Orange and looking at that book and another book called Brighton Rock. And
That's fine.
Can we? Because you can cut stuff, right?
I can. I don't usually. No. I actually keep all of it in, but I can cut it for you, Rory.
Thank you. Do you know what? It's just weird. I suddenly got flustered. I don't ever get flustered, but I just...
The stakes are high.
The stakes are so high. Yeah. I've done... Okay.
Clockwork Orange.
I think it's just my... I don't know. Maybe I'm a little bit disorientated with this cold. But anyway... I'm going to backtrack and just start again so it's easier for you. Yeah, so here we go. So, yeah, how I sort of got into directing was sort of around the houses a little bit. I grew up in Portugal, actually, because my parents worked in the tourism industry. I went to a school, the International School of the Algarve. It wasn't a big school. There was only sort of like 25, 30 kids in my class. It was English language. And as a result, because it was so small, I ended up sort of playing a lot of the major parts, even though I'm not the world's greatest actor, you know, and I was playing sort of Macbeth, you know, really gracing the boards, getting five stars.
Come on.
No, it was terrible. But I was quite into acting, although there was a part of me that knew that I wasn't that sort of talented at it. And then, I was same teacher, taught my English literature class. We were studying A Clockwork Orange, the book by Anthony Burgess. And she was a bit of a hippie. I was 15. But she was a bit of a hippie, and she decided that it was okay for 15-year-olds to watch the movie. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, but it's quite, you know, it's quite intense, especially for a 15-year-old. So she said, your homework is go home, watch the movie. So I went home and I watched it, and I absolutely hated it. I thought it was terrible. And the reason I hated it was that I thought that this guy, whoever he was, I didn't know what I was talking about, but I was like, whoever this guy was, he completely missed the point of the book. And so the next day I went into school, and my teacher said, you know, she went around the class and she was like, so what did you think of the movie? Blah, blah, blah. She said, Rory, you usually talk a lot. What do you think? And I said this to her. I was like, well, this guy, this director, whoever he was, he completely missed the point of Anthony Burgess's book. And my teacher said, that's interesting. I want you to go back and sort of watch it again and imagine this time that a director's job is to just interpret that, like, this is just one person's point of view on this text. There's no, you know, a film doesn't have to just sort of completely faithfully reinterpret the book. It can be one person's point of view. And I went back and watched the movie again, and it changed my life, like, sincerely. Like, after that, I completely understood the sort of job of a director, and I decided that that was what I wanted to do. And I was like 15, and I started making these really bad short films that will never see the light of day. I used to edit trailers on YouTube as well, like game. I was very into games, and I used to, like, Halo. I used to re-edit trailers and stuff.
Was there editing features on Halo?
No,
I mean on YouTube. Sorry.
Oh God, look, this is bad. But I I had you know Sony Vegas.
No.
So it was this, like, editing software. I don't know if it's the same. I mean, I haven't edited anything in like 10 years, so I don't know if it's the same. But
it's come a long way.
Yeah. But I had I was quite naughty. I had like a cracked version of it. Okay. You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like a pirated thing?
Yeah, yeah. And I used to just sort of make the videos on that. Because it was like, I was like 15, and it was like £300 or something for this editing software. So yeah, I used to edit my own little videos there. They were terrible. So then I moved back to the UK, and there was a brief stint where I sort of wanted to be a politician. I worked in the Houses of Parliament. I don't know, sort of how many people in America know this. This may come across as incredibly patronizing, but you know where Big Ben is? Like, that's actually where our government is, right? Okay. And so it was kind of mad at sort of 18 or so to be in that building, you know, for 9 months. I worked there, and I sort of decided that politics wasn't for me. Sort of went to undergrad.
How did you end up in that building?
Yeah, so I really wanted to be a director.
Right.
And I left school, you know, finished school at 18, and decided to take a gap year, which we do a little bit in England, of sort of, between school and university, taking a year off. And I went to, I just sort of applied to, it was like 200 jobs or something. I just sent all of these emails off, and I got about 5 interviews out of like 200. Yeah. And one of them was, for this member of parliament, this politician, to be his intern. And it was his chief of staff, and we really hit it off. And it was only a 3-month contract, and they liked me so much, I sort of ended up being there for 9 months.
Wow.
They even sort of offered me a job when I graduated university. They were like, if you want to come back. And so there was a career in politics that I could have had.
Yeah.
But I just, it wasn't for me, like, that whole environment. I decided that what was more interesting for me was sort of, you know, examining society and culture and politics through the lens of art making, rather than being in it itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So in that summer, I actually came here to America. I did a program called Camp America, where British sort of kids end up being counselors at like camps around here. And I was the head of drama at a kids camp in Ohio. Carrollton, Ohio. They gave me the choice of LA or Ohio, and I chose Ohio. You're looking at me very strangely. I chose Ohio because I was like, when will I ever go to Ohio? You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I've never been back. It was good. No, it was nice. It was nice. I loved Ohio.
Oh, I'm sure Ohio's great. I've never been to Ohio.
Lots of Amish where I was, actually, which was fascinating because we didn't have anything like that. So I
picture you just like chatting with your friends, you know, over in England, and you're like, should I go to Ohio or LA? And they're like pulling one over on you, and they're like, no, Ohio's the new LA, and you don't know any better.
So they got a real burgeoning sort of film scene in Ohio. Yeah,
with no electricity and horses.
Yeah, they just, you know, it's all DIY. It's indie movies. So I ran the kids camp, the drama program there, and then went to undergrad. And sort of studied history because, you know, still wanted to have an academic background. I mean, I'm a big history nerd. And then in the 3 years that I was in undergrad at University of York, I directed, like, I don't know, it was like in 3 years, maybe 20 things. And it was all theatre. Yeah. So I started to move from film to theatre.
How did all these opportunities come up for you, though, so quickly?
Like, so my dad is a very sort of self-made man. My parents really instilled in me from a young age is if you want to do something, you got to do it yourself. Like there's no one's going to help you. Right.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why. Also, I'm an Aries. I'm not really into astrology, but I think that I am an Aries in that I'm very impulsive and very sort of driven. And so I just I just go for something. Like if I really want something, I just sort of I'm very single minded. I just I think for me, what's really helped me in my career so far is having one single goal that I'm always working towards every day. So that means that you know, in a day, even if I'm a bit lazy and I don't do anything, as long as I accomplish one thing in my day that is going towards that one goal, then I feel as if I'm sort of on the right track, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
And, you know, there is this, I think it's a very sort of, it's in a lot of self-help books and things, I think, but this idea of, I think it really is true, this sort of idea of if you can visualize it, you can do it. Like, you're never going to achieve something if you can't see it ahead of you, right? Because you're just going to be going through the weeds. Mm-hmm. And so even from a young age, I had the visualizations I had were massive and crazy. You know, I was like, when I was 18, I was like, okay, I want to be either a director, a politician, or I think also a comedian at one point. But putting those big visualizations in front of me meant that when I applied to hundreds of jobs, they were very specific. And even though I only got interviews for five, it meant that I could talk quite clearly and articulately about why I wanted to work in politics or whatever, for example. And what's just happened over time, I think, as I've got older, is what I want has sort of whittled down until it's just one thing. You know, I'm directing for me is just sort of, I realized, you know, it'd always been there, but it wasn't until I went to undergrad and I started doing it a lot more frequently that I realized it was something that was just very easy and very, it felt very natural and I really sort of enjoyed doing.
Yeah.
So I didn't do anything else. I didn't do my degree really. I just sort of focused on directing. The thing about England is very different to America is when you go to university in the UK, you only do one subject for 3 years. And also your contact hours, like i.e. when you're in seminars or lectures, are actually quite low. So I ended up, you know, by my last year, I was in classes for about 4 hours a week, right? That's it.
What?
Yeah, 4 hours a week. They treat you, you have to be like, they're trying to treat you like an academic, you know, you're reading books on your own and all that.
Right.
And so I just ended up just relentlessly directing, just constantly. It was all I was doing.
Were you looking for these opportunities? These opportunities were looking for you?
There was a drama society at my university, which is pretty bad, in the sense like, I shouldn't say that because I do love it, but, it's just like a barn. It was an old farm barn at this university that had been converted into a theater space and run by students since the 1960s. It was like a student society. It wasn't run by the university or whatever. But it has like quite prestigious people have come out of it. For example, Simon Stevens, the playwright who did Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, you know, the stage adaptation. The ex-artistic director of a theater in London called the Lyric Hammersmith, Anthony Horowitz, if you know that author. He wrote it's a book series. I can't remember. It's very famous. But so it's got quite a good reputation. And the reason for that, I think, is because it's a student-run space, you can do whatever you want to it. So it allowed real creativity. And the first year I got there, it was quite a cliquey society, and I pitched to get in about three times, different shows. You would pitch, and then they would choose shows to be put on. And they didn't take any of my shows. And then finally, in the last semester of first year, they said yes. And then that was it. And then once I was kind of in, I was like, I'm not letting go of this. And I just sort of kept pitching things and kept getting things on. And then I went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival as well. I did the Edinburgh Fringe like three times, took about three shows in total. I did a festival called the National Student Drama Festival in Britain as well. It just became like an obsession. I think, I don't know what it's like here, but in Europe or in Britain, or at least in British schools, no one ever tells you that directing, for example, is like a career, like it's something that you can do. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, you know, everyone knows about acting, everyone knows about, you know, even film directing, but theatre directing, there was no real clear route into it. And I still don't think there is. I think it's, you kind of stumble into it a little bit, you know, you have to sort of find your own way a bit. To get into it.
Yeah, no, that's true, I guess. Yeah, I don't know, because it's also like in theater, and I've said this in other episodes, theater is trending.
Yeah,
it seems
right
here, I think.
Would you mean by that?
I think from some of like the TV shows like Smash and Glee and what have you, there's more actors or people pursuing acting than ever before.
Right.
But it's interesting because I had a similar conversation with a couple casting directors, and they think the opposite. So I don't know if it's like if it's what you focus on, you find, or if it's
actually true. So they think that less people are actually going into it. Now. Yeah. That's kind of interesting.
What do you think?
I don't know. Someone said to me, I don't know what you think about this, but someone said to me that the people who sort of make it in the theater industry are the people who just sort of stay in it.
Yeah.
Like the longest, you know, like I think that a lot of people start out in acting or directing or whatever, but either they find their way into something else in a similar field, or they move on to something entirely different, you know, like they go into banking or something.
Yeah.
Because I think, I mean, freelancing especially is it's really difficult, but you know everyone says that is not true, but I've heard people say like that every other person in the theater industry, be that like a playwright, a director, a stage manager or whatever, are all just frustrated actors, you know?
Maybe a little bit true.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, I don't know whether or not they're frustrated, but definitely the trend seems to be that like anyone else who does anything in the theater started out as an actor.
I believe that.
Agents, casting directors.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, I just realized I couldn't do it. You know what I mean? Like I was okay. Like it was fine when I was in school. And then actually when I got to undergrad, I started auditioning for stuff. And I ended up getting, you know, like, do you know Animal Farm, George Orwell, right? You know,
good book.
Yeah. Well, someone had turned it into a play and they were doing it and I auditioned for it. And, I got the role of the farmer. Now, do you remember the farmer from the book?
Vague.
No. Yeah. Vaguely. You won't, because he's killed like in the first two pages. And that was kind of like a wake up call to me that actually this is not the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. You know, not only was I the farmer, I was Pig 3. And Pig 3 was brought on at a certain point with a bucket on his head and was executed. And I had three lines. So, you know, not like a...
And that was it for you.
Yeah, not the next Leonardo DiCaprio or something. You know, it was...
oh, my God.
Yeah, that was the end. I realized, you know what? I think that this is not the right path for me. But I don't know, you know, like... sort of, I could go back to it at some point. It might be fun.
Yeah. I mean, the opportunity is always there. There's always going to be some time, some place for you to do that. But okay, so then what was the, I hope I'm not skipping too much.
No, no, no.
What was the transition then from coming over the pond, you know, skipping over the pond?
So, so basically I was at, undergrad and I'd done all these different shows. And while I was at undergrad, I'd read a couple of books by a theatre director and sort of theoretician called Anne Bogart, sort of legendary American theatre director. And she'd written Viewpoints, you know, the sort of movement stuff, and a number of different books like Conversations with Anne. And I really liked her approach to theater. I liked the way that she talked about it. And I'd always had this suspicion that great artists have great mentors, right? Like you can kind of look back at an artist's trajectory and see how different people have sort of influenced and helped them on the way. And I wanted to sort of work with a great director. And it's a very rare program at Columbia University where, you know, Anne Bogart runs the directing program, takes 6 students a year. And it's just her, like you get to spend sort of 3 years with her and a guy called Brian Kulik, who used to run Classic Stage Company.
So how did you get in?
Well, so here's the thing, right? I didn't, you know, like, how are you here now then? So I was like 21 when I auditioned. I was really young. I was still at, undergrad, and I went, and you do this mad, I'm realizing I'm saying mad a lot. What's the synonym? Crazy.
Crazy.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know,
switch it up.
Yeah, sure. I have a little bit of a larger vocabulary than it.
You know, it's funny. I was listening to myself the other day on one of these, and I was like, wow, I say et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like that 3 times a lot.
Like in all of your interviews?
Yeah.
Like every single one.
That was the first time I said it for this one. Yeah.
There we go. Well, you've got to keep your brand. You know,
I got to cut it down to 1, though, maybe. Just you don't say mad, mad, mad.
Well, who knows? Maybe I'm going to do another podcast after this where all I say is mad as my descriptor. So anyway, what was I saying? Yeah. So I came.
Lunatic. There was crazy.
Well, they do this. So Anne does this crazy thing where she invites 25 applicants, like she whittles it down to 25 applicants and invites them over here to New York to audition, and it's basically 48 hours of directing. That's all you're doing, and you're doing it in front of her and other people, and you have to act as well, by the way. And basically what you have to do is you have to sort of present a piece and another director acts in it. And, you know, they have to be completely off book, and it has to be completely costumed and lit and everything. And my one went okay. And then I went to do the piece for the director that I was working with. And it was all going well. I mean, I get incredible stage fright. Like I was really sort of nervous, and I was doing the piece. It was this like... you know, I did a poem, and I had to pick up this rope and walk towards this light bulb, which was in this box in the middle of the stage. And I'm sort of picking it up, and I'm going, and I'm remembering the lines, and it's going well, and people are making noise in the audience. I'm like, oh my gosh, maybe I am an actor after all. And then suddenly they're making noise, and the lights are flipped on, and I realize that someone's screaming at me and pointing at the box. And the director had put the light bulb too close to the rope, and the rope was on fire. Yeah. And so I had to run over and stamp this rope out. And anyway, we reset, and I was so sort of knocked out by that. And they weren't going to use the light bulb again for health and safety reasons. So they put a load of phones in the box and turned the flashlights on, and we turned the lights off, and I couldn't see anything. And I'm just sort of wandering around the stage saying line, trying to find this rope. But this poor girl, like whose piece it was, she was obviously like really sort of upset. And I went afterwards and sort of comforted her. And anyway, I didn't think I'd get in, because I was like, there was, you know, we almost set the place on fire. And I didn't, I got on the waiting list. Yeah. And I thought that was that. And I decided to take 2 shows to the Edinburgh Fringe that year. And we were in rehearsals, and this was, in sort of July of 2014. And, I hadn't checked my emails because I'd just been, like just rehearsing so much. I hadn't really been on my computer, and I didn't have a smartphone. And I went on my emails on my computer, and I had like 5 emails from Anne being like, someone's dropped out, do you want to come, blah blah blah. This was 3 weeks before the program was due to start, by the way.
And you're here or you're back?
I was in London. Yeah. So I was rehearsing the show that was going to the Edinburgh Fringe.
Right.
And so I didn't know what to do, you know. So I rang my dad and I was like, you know, the fees are like $60,000. There's no way we can pay for this. You know, I don't have anywhere to live. I don't really know anyone over there. Should I take this? And, you know, I was, now 22. And my dad gave me the best piece of advice. He was like, just go. And he was like, you'll figure it out when you get over there. Like, we'll buy you the plane ticket. Just go out there and try and make it work. And 5 years later, I'm still here, like, which is kind of nuts, you know. And had to, over the course of that time, find different sources of income and, you know, sort of scholarshiped up to my eyeballs and just sort of trying to get through the program. But it was the best decision I made because it was 3 years to just really work on your voice as an artist. And I think it's an amazing, also to be in a class of just six directors, including yourself. It's amazing to sort of be that intimate with other people's work and other people's work that's so different from yours. You know, there was a woman in my class who is from Iceland and had a very sort of unique aesthetic to her work. There was another amazing artist from Argentina who is a film director who turned into a theater director. You know, it was a guy from Norway. You know, it was just a collection of people from around the world, and just seeing. And I think that the most vital thing in art and where the best art is made is when it's in dialogue. It's like a culture in dialogue with another culture, or a voice in dialogue with another voice, because it's sort of only like that you can really sort of learn something.
Oh yeah.
And I graduated in 2017. And I've just sort of been working in the industry since then, you know.
And now, okay, so this is really interesting to me because I don't know how it works for directors. You're studying at Columbia.
Yeah.
Are you contacting other people here in the city saying, hey, can I shadow you?
Yeah.
Be your assistant, get you coffee? Like, what was that?
Yeah, well, because that's what's weird, right? Because, like, I actually, in some ways, and I don't mean this in a sort of woe is me kind of way, but I do think that directors have it more difficult. Young directors have it more difficult than, say, young actors, because as an actor, there's always, pardon me, there's always auditions, and there's always something. You can always go somewhere and audition for something.
Yeah.
Whereas as a director, it's self-generated, really. Yeah. Everything. You have to be someone who isn't afraid of reaching out to people and afraid of making your own opportunities. So what I did was I blasted emails out to everyone while I was still at Columbia to
like, to who? How did you find those emails?
Well
or any stories that you can share.
No, and also the other thing you do is you have to just make your own work, you know. And I was lucky enough to do a lot of that when I was in undergrad, just sort of self-generating material and taking it to the Edinburgh Fringe. So I had a sort of backbone in that. It was kind of not mad, it was kind of crazy. Now I'm going to use crazy too much. you know, my first job out of Columbia was the assistant director on M Butterfly on Broadway that Julie Taymor directed. I was her assistant director. And David Henry Wong, who's the playwright, he was a professor at Columbia. And this is what I mean about sort of making your own opportunities. I was also a burgeoning playwright. Like I've directed a lot of the plays that I've written as well. Like I kind of write material for myself and then direct it. And that's what I did. I used to do a lot of the Edinburgh Fringe. And, you know, I reached out to David while I was at Columbia and said, hey, like, is there any way I could do like a kind of private study with you? And he was like, yeah, of course, you know. And it was only because I asked that he would, you know, that opportunity would have sort of never been open to me if I hadn't known about that. And so we spent, you know, a semester together where he was mentoring me on some plays that I'd written. And then we were having sort of coffee one day and I asked him what he had coming up. And he said, you know, Julie was going to be directing M Butterfly. And I sort of gushed about, I'd just seen Midsummer Night's Dream that she did at Theatre for a New Audience. And, you know, obviously The Lion King and her films like across the universe. I'd always been a big fan of her vision, and I sort of gushed to him and said I would learn so much from her, like I can't believe blah blah, and he was like, yeah, well, why don't you write a letter to her and I'll send it to her. So I did that, and she didn't respond for 6 months, and then I got like a one line letter back being like, yeah, I'll meet you. And then we ended up meeting, and it was only supposed to be like a 20-minute meeting, and we spent about 2.5 hours together, and we realized we sort of had a lot artistically in common, and I just sort of went into, you know, because it's really, as you can probably tell from this podcast as well, the reason I'm not an actor and the reason I'm a director is I find the idea of any kind of self-publicity or any kind of self... Like anywhere where I have to be on a stage or in front of people, I find it incredibly nerve-wracking. Like I'm sort of riddled with anxiety, and it's sort of weirdly, I guess, sadomasochistic that I work in this industry because I'm surrounded by people who can do it so amazingly. But I know I love that. Like, yeah, that's why I do it. I like, yeah, I have like a huge love and admiration for actors because it's like something that I can't do. Like I physically, and the further I get away from those days in high school where I was like playing Macbeth or whatever,
yeah,
the harder I find it. Like, because I can't turn off my director brain, you know, it's always like, I'm always analyzing everything. But anyway, so like even going to have a meeting with someone like her or whatever is incredibly nerve wracking, of course.
Of course.
But, you know, I spoke to a friend of mine who was like, you know, you just go in there and just treat it as if you want to learn from her. Right. And that has sort of been the best piece of advice that I've received on sort of interviewing, and is that the best thing to do is really quite honestly just communicate like what you really honestly want out of that situation, right? And in that circumstance, rather than trying to big myself up or, you know, pander to what I thought she might be looking for, I just went in there and was like, I want to learn from you. I love your work.
Yeah.
And I guess she responded to that because we ended up working together. And that's the same thing as like, obviously, I'm nowhere near that point in my career yet, but, you know, I've had assistant directors and I've worked with people, you know, on my projects who are sort of starting out. And that's the thing that I always look for as well, is like, are you genuinely passionate about the same things that I am, you know? And I think that is like really important, is for any sort of directors starting out, I think what you have to do is you just have to really figure out whose art you're interested in. You don't even have to know what kind of art you want to make yet, but figure out whose art you're interested in and find a way to reach out to those people.
Yeah.
And just ask if you can do something, like, you know, get the coffee or do the whatever, or just be in the room, because that, you know, you get to learn from those people, and then those people sort of get to know you as well, and your network just becomes sort of bigger and bigger, or your tribe, I guess, is a better word for it.
Yeah, that's a 2019 word for it, right?
Tribe. Yeah, yeah.
Build your tribe.
Yeah, build your tribe, your theater tribe.
So you're doing M. Butterfly.
Yeah.
And you're hitting it off with Julie.
Yeah.
So to speak. What were the following projects that came up?
Yeah, so I mean, I've done a lot of, since I've graduated, I've done a lot of weird stuff. I've done a lot of my own work. I did, so my thesis was Macbeth, which I'm sort of currently trying to remount. I directed at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts quite a bit. I did Richard III there. I did...
Was that another connection through...
Well, yeah, the guy
Columbia,
who...
Or was that your own?
No, thing? No. So this is another thing, is you just got to do the work and invite people to it, really, as a director. Yeah. You know, I invited a bunch of people to my thesis, and one of them was the head of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, who came because there was a couple of his ex-students in the show. And he reached out to me afterwards and was like, you seem to be good at Shakespeare. Do you want to do a Shakespeare at our school? And so I did that. And then I did, a new Canadian play there. And then I put up my own work. I did, there's a very close collaborator of mine. Me and him completely devised a completely new play about a jazz musician. And then I also worked at Roundabout Theatre Company as a sort of an artistic apprentice in my last year at Columbia. Since then I've worked on Seawall, A Life, and also currently working on Ink, which is at MTC on Broadway. I've kind of begun to split my career into three sectors, which is my own work, my work for other people, i.e. assistant or associate directing, and then also teaching. Like I mentor directing students at NYU as well. And you find that each sector nourishes the other sector, and that you can't, like, if you get burnt out, if you're just directing too much, you get burnt out. If you're just ADing, you get burnt out. If you're just teaching, you have to kind of have a balance of all of them, and they all kind of help each one, I think, a little bit. Yeah.
What have you learned from working with these, like, top performers or heavy hitters?
Yeah.
Are there lessons that you've taken away about their work ethic or your work ethic?
Yeah. I think so. I think,
one or two.
Yeah. I think a big thing is communication. And I think that, this is going to be the most pretentious thing I say today, maybe. This job, like being in the theater, I think is all about human connection. Like, what it boils down to at the end of the day is like human connection and truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, the more I work with, like sort of big people in the industry, the more I realize it's just about forging real, like, vulnerable relationships. People want to just feel sort of safe, and in a context where they can do the work that they want to do, if that makes sense. Like,
it does.
Like, it's not about, like, the prestige and the status and everything. It's not about anything like that. It's about just doing the work. And, you know, it was Bryan Cranston, I think, right, who said, he was talking about, someone was asking him about, like, how he got his break in the industry and what advice he would have to young actors about auditioning. And he said, just go in and sort of tell your story. You know, just go in there and audition and just treat it as if, like, okay, I have a captive audience here. I'm just going to tell my story to them. Because that somehow makes it more truthful. Because, like, when you're auditioning or something, if your eye is always on the prize or the thing that's ahead of you, then you're never going to be sort of truthful in the moment. And I realize that I'm sort of contradicting what I'm saying earlier about, like, always having an idea of where you want to be. But I do think that those two things are separate. It's like you in the moment being truthful and honest with who you are and what you want and what the parameters of that are. And then the wider thing, which is outside of that, of, like, you know, just for you, like, this is where I'm sort of aiming in the future. Mm-hmm. Because I think that people can usually smell when someone is just trying to, like, game them or something, right? Like, when they're not being truthful or honest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Use them for personal
gain. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, you can smell that.
Yeah.
You can, genuine. When someone's not being genuine, you can definitely tell.
Yeah, I think so.
What have you learned about, so I want to kind of riff on this, the human communication and being truthful and honest and seeing someone, you know, like, I see you in a way. What have you learned about human communication then from communicating with actors in rehearsal process?
Like, is this more on an existential level about, like, what do I think about sort of the way humans interact with each other? Or do you mean, like, literally on a practical level of, like, how have I changed as a director? Like, how?
Yeah, let's start practical.
Yeah,
and then we can go then we can go to existential.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think that this honesty, I'm going to go further with this honesty thing. Like, I think that, I don't know, like, when you start directing, when you're kind of just throwing a lot of, you know, crap at the wall and hoping that some of it sticks. You don't really know what you're doing. So the way that you talk to people often is you're not, like, you don't know how to elicit the best, like, how do I best help an actor get to the place that they need to get to? I guess the number one thing that I've learned as I've got further into it is that you know, a character, in my opinion, and I, you know, could be completely wrong, but this is what I do and I think about as a director, is that a character is just an agreement between a director and an actor. Like, the actor thinks that a character is one thing, the director thinks the character is another thing, maybe, and then the actual character, the one that you see on stage, is the agreement that the director and the actor have sort of forged together, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think that the idea that the director is sort of, that their voice is like paramount, is definitely wrong. Like, I think that best directors are sort of collaborative. Like, I see myself as sort of like a world builder. Like, I build the world and then give the actors enough leeway to sort of play within it and create their own, you know, worlds within the world that we've sort of created outside of that.
Yeah.
And I think as I've sort of progressed through the industry, yeah, I've realized that the best directors have that sort of ethos, like this idea that it's, you know, that the room, that when you go into the rehearsal room, there's like a joy and a real excavation of like, of the play and of the character that's taking place together, like that the director and the actor and everyone in the room are sort of working together, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and going back to sort of Julie, you know, when I worked with her, she's obviously, her work is so like specific and, you know, has a very specific aesthetic and a very specific kind of lens, the way everything is being presented. But she was incredibly collaborative with actors. Like, I, you know, she wasn't being like, stand here and say this thing in this exact way. It's like, what do you think about this? Because that's the way that it's going to seem more truthful for the audience, right? As if the actor completely understands every single moment in the play, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Well, yeah, because then it doesn't look put on.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like you're doing something someone else told you to do. You're doing what you...
And I think, yeah, and I think that as you... I don't know, I think as you sort of go on and you direct more as well, you realize what you're saying is faff, and you can sort of cut it down and be more lean and know when to listen and not to talk. And, you know, sometimes actors just need to figure out things on their own as well. And there's a strength in sometimes just being silent and allowing that to happen, you know? Yeah.
Have you found yourself speaking less and listening more, or listening less and speaking more from the days in the barn to...
Yeah, the days in the barn. I know it might not seem like this on this podcast, but definitely speaking less and listening more. I think that there's like a weird insecurity when you start out where you have to explain everything, like every idea. And there are just things that aren't useful for actors. Like, you don't need to... Like, as I said earlier, I'm a massive history nerd. And so when I'm directing a play, if there's any historical context in it, or if there's any kind of parallel or something, I do all this massive background reading just because it nourishes me and it makes for me the design and everything more full, right? But the actor doesn't need to know that stuff, you know, unless they want to, because it's like that you can really get in someone's way, you know. It's like the classic example is like, you know, an actor doing something like really hilarious in a show, and then that night the director being like, oh my god, that was so funny, and this is why it was funny, and then they go on stage the next day and it's not funny, and it's because they've just over explained the joke and the construction of the joke, like, rather than just letting the actor, you know, sort of find it themselves, because at the end of the day it's not me who's on stage, right? So
true.
Yeah.
Are there common pieces of incorrect advice that you've heard in your field?
Common pieces of incorrect advice. Oh, yeah, probably. I'm trying to think. But that's the thing, is this is the thing about, like, the other thing, right, that I really believe is that this is what works for me. And then for another director, something else entirely will work.
You can have a completely different conversation.
Yeah, like I've worked with directors where... let me give you an example, right? Like, so when I direct a play, I go into the process knowing exactly like what the world is. I don't know what happens in every scene. Like, I don't know the exact blocking of every scene. I'm not one of those directors who writes down, like, you know,
on this line, yeah, cross stage left.
Yeah. Well, that I do think is death. Like, I do think that that is like the idea that, yes, okay, I do have one thing, and then I'll go back to what I'm saying. I do have one thing that I think is a correct, incorrect piece of advice. The idea that actors are in any way sort of marionettes or just like meat puppets or
that
something.
Makes sense.
But you do see, you know, I know some people who think like, well, they are just sort of conduits for the lines to be spoken out of. You know, like, I think that a great mentor of mine said something I thought was brilliant, which I love, which is that film is all about light and theater is all about actors. Like, that theater really at its core is the actor's art form. Because it's just them up there, you know, and they have to, like in film, you could, if you had a bad actor at the core of your movie, you could actually hide it. Like, I think you could, or you could
edit it.
You could present them in a way where it seems like a choice, right? Whereas in theater, like, if you're doing Hamlet and the person playing Hamlet is like awful, you're in trouble, you know what I mean? Like, because you have to sustain that attention anyway.
Of course.
So that's, you know, that's that. But what I was saying is that every director is so different. I have, like, the story that I thought was really interesting is that, so for me, I know what the world is before I go in, and then I want the actors to kind of collaborate and sort of come up with their own ideas within that framework. So an example would be, like, I did a production of Macbeth where I knew that it was sort of a contemporary, an exaggerated contemporary reality, and we were looking at, like, the excesses of celebrity, and it was about this guy who, like, in our world, Macbeth became this massive sort of celebrity when he comes home at the beginning of the play from killing MacDonald. And then with Duncan, he sort of goes into this world of excess. Like, there was all these orgies and drugs and stuff. And, you know, at the core, like, I knew how, like, that was the arc of the play for us, that we were examining sort of, you know, the excesses of celebrity culture. I knew how it ended. I had some sort of movement sequences, some music and things like that I had in mind. But within that, like, the actors were allowed to sort of present their own, I mean, allowed isn't even the right word. The actors were encouraged to present their own ideas and their own, you know, and collaborate and come up with stuff. And then I did a show with a director who is amazing, but I was terrified because it seemed as if, like, so there was no overarching vision to begin with, and we stuffed the play full of so much and every idea was encouraged, because there was no framework, it was never moving towards anything. There was just loads of ideas being like, yeah, let's do that and do that and do that, so that by the time we got to previews, the world was full of every possible idea that this play could hold.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is too much. Like, I was really scared. I was like, this thing's going to fail. It's like so bloated and whatever. And I realized she started to, in previews, just cut everything away until eventually it was just one thing. It became so simple, and it became so, and I completely realized that it was a director who had such a different voice and a different vision to my own. And it was so genius in her own way that she wanted to explore every avenue and then come to the one that she wanted to explore, rather than what I do, which is start at my avenue, and then the ideas are come in that one way. It's just an entirely different way of using your brain. You know, that the idea of doing that is terrifying to me. Like, the idea of just everything being a possibility is too much. Like, again, it's the Aries thing, right? It's like, I can only see one thing.
Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, that would. I mean, I can only imagine what people thought at the first preview.
Yeah, well, it was amazing. It was the first preview was great, and it was because it, like, as soon as we finished it, you know, she was like, "This is going." Like, it was I was like, "Wow, this person is." A genius director, because it was just really mind blowing, because it was such a different way of of directing to me. And so that, and that's sort of the point that I wanted to make, is that I don't feel like there is one way to direct. It's about finding out what your, what works for your impulses, you know. Yeah. like if I tried to direct like that, it would be a disaster, because I wouldn't know what to cut, if that makes sense. I need to have the idea. Like I need to have the idea first, you know. Like you have some directors who are visual directors, you know, that they have an idea of what the world looks like before they direct it. There are some who are, you know, text based, and it's all about really deep excavation with the actors. I always thought I was a visual director, and then I realized sort of into my second year at Columbia that I'm actually an oral director, that I get inspiration, and I get images, and I get the play through music. And that's where I start. With every play that I direct, I start with a piece of music that for me encapsulates what the world feels like, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's very, I don't know. Yeah. It works for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This conversation has been fascinating. Now I'm repeating words.
No,
hey. No, it has. It's really interesting to hear the other side of, not the other side, but another piece of creating art.
Well, yeah. I mean, what, like, I'm curious, it's from your point of view, like, do you, you know, like, is, as an actor, what is it that draws you to theater? You know, like,
I love telling stories.
Really?
That's why I do this.
Yeah.
Your story, like your personal story. I think there's so much to learn from someone else's story.
Well, cause yeah.
I mean, and art is made to educate. I mean, that's, it's education in a way. It can be entertaining, but you can still learn something. Like, yeah. Kinky Boots closed yesterday. Musical comedy.
Very sad. Yeah.
Very big themes in there for someone to learn.
Yeah.
And it was actually written and directed in a wonderful way that could even keep someone who may not be fully open-minded,
yeah,
to those themes. Mm-hmm. They could still learn something. Mm-hmm. Really brilliant to me. So I'm all about storytelling.
Yeah. I guess I'm just quickly very curious about, like, when you work on a piece, like as an actor, and when you get cast in something, like, for example, you did Cabaret, right?
Yeah.
Is it exciting for you that you're getting to, like, be a part of a larger world? Or like I'm just curious about, you know, because, like, for me, the reason I couldn't be an actor is that, and I why I was so bad at it is, what, while I was acting, I was always telling everyone else what they should be doing, or, like, you know, because I was thinking of, like, the bigger picture.
You can't stay in your own lane. I have the same thing, though. There's projects I've worked on where I've been in the back of the ensemble,
right,
and felt like I'm actually teaching the world something, because the overall arc direction of the piece was so educational. Everyone was so critical. Every person in the show was so critical in telling that story.
Yeah.
That I felt like I had worth. Mm. You know what I mean? And then I've done projects where it's been none of that.
Yeah.
And I'm in the ensemble, and it's like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Yeah.
You know? So it's, well, I think it's a mixed bag, depends on the project, but definitely, I mean, for the very most part, I do feel as though I'm contributing.
Well, I guess a good thing about being an actor is you could take a project that you don't really care about, but if you know, if it pays well, like, you know, like, because there is,
get,
know,
some money.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, you do a commercial for dog food, you're not, like, gonna be like, you know, this commercial I think is really gonna change the way we perceive dog food. I mean, unless it does, you know, unless it's like a kind of, you know, genre changing dog food or something. Like, world,
for the most part,
changing. Yeah, like, whereas as a director, you can't, I mean, I guess you can do that a little bit if you're in film or whatever, you can direct commercials and stuff, but it's hard being the originator of a project. You always have to, I think you always have to, there's a deep level of care that you have to have, or for me at least, to draw me to a show.
This isn't, yeah, I agree with you. And I think it's interesting because I'm at the beginning of an acting career,
yeah,
and I consider it to be very fulfilling, yet at the same time
I've been in productions where everything is great, and then we get to the space and like the sound system's crap,
right? Yeah,
or something, and that to me is rather irritating. Yeah. Although I won't articulate or say anything about it personally, it's irritating. So I think there's a balance of finding, you know, because I definitely want to perform, but also where in there can I hold more power to make sure that everything is perfect.
That sounds like
Lee telling the story.
That sounds like a producer. If you talk, that's kind of what it sounds like.
But it's that, you know, because I like, I'd say I'm a perfectionist.
But you know, like, the guy sort of came out of the drama barn. Simon Stevens, as I was talking about earlier, he said something that sort of really stayed with me a long time ago, which was, like that creativity comes from limitation, that like whenever he writes a play, for a long time he was actually thinking about the drama barn when he was writing, because it was so limited. And I think that, like, you know, as when I see those limitations as a director, for me they're exciting, like that they're actually, I think that sometimes the further up the chain you get, the harder it becomes, because the limitations become less and less and you can kind of do more. And you know, like if there was a bad sound system and it wasn't going to work, you know, there's a world where I'd be like, okay, well, we'll scrap all the recorded sound and we'll just create it all on stage, you know. And then you find something new out of that. Like, that is, for me, that's like really, really exciting, right?
Really creative.
Whereas
you don't find that until the end of the process.
When I was an actor, it was like that stuff would be, and it's the frustrated actor thing. For me, I would be like, oh no, like, you know, like I want to, like, I know how we can fix this thing, but it's not my place to say it, you know. It's like, which is difficult. But some people love, you know, because, you know, one of my best friends who's an actor loves, why he loves acting and will never do anything else, and he's tried directing and didn't really enjoy it, is the ability to sort of tell his own story within a larger framework is like really exciting to him. Like, the, you know, the idea of like being able to really work very closely on crafting one character and like the minutiae of that rather than the whole picture is like, is really exciting for him. Whereas for me, like, I can't narrow down like that. I'm always thinking big picture. Yeah.
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 I think we'll all find a balance in there somewhere with any of that. I mean, yeah, it's just interesting to navigate life and your path and what you're interested in and where your interests will take you. Okay. So as we're wrapping up here, is there metaphorically a word or a phrase that you would put on a billboard for millions of people to see? And it can be, now this could be a quote from a play. This can be like a self-help quote. This can be a word. This can be a short story, as long or as short as you want it. Something that speaks to you that would speak to others. Does anything come to mind?
Yes, I know what you're saying. There is something recently, I think it changes a lot, but really recently the phrase that I like, and it's not mine at all, I think it's like a pretty common phrase, you probably heard it before, is I want to get it right. It's the words you speak are the house you live in. Like, okay. That I really believe that. Like, I think that the way you choose to define yourself is the way that you will define yourself, because internally it's the way you will look at the world, and externally it's the way the world will look at you, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. And I don't know. And I think that, you know, the power of positive thinking and all that stuff is there is a truth to that. Like, the idea of if you have a bright, sunny, optimistic outlook, or you can kind of verbalize the things that you want in life, or, you know, and then you go for them in a positive way, you're going to stand a much better chance than if you're, you know, saying that it's never going to happen. Well, then, yeah, it probably is not.
It's true. I happen to be in big agreement with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you focus on, you find.
Yeah. I mean,
focus on the good, you find it. Focus on the bad, you'll find it.
Exactly. And also, the thing is that we craft our own realities, right? Like, like the way we view, like, and this is, I mean, I'm just repeating a quote, but the way we view the world is what the world becomes for us. Like, because, you know, we forget that, like, we're all just different, like, we all have such different outlooks and views and things. And the only thing that we can really control is the way that we are dealing with the world. And I don't know, I that has become for me a big, because it is difficult, like on the surface, like, you know, I came out of sort of grad school and immediately booked a very good gig, and I've been lucky enough to work, like, the first sort of year out of grad school I made a living entirely just from directing and AD work, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But there have also been times where I haven't worked for months on end, or it looked like I wasn't going to work at all, you know. And it's about having the positive outlook and having the sort of ability to go on. And also, I think that what's important as well in this industry is kindness. I think that, you know, there's another really great phrase that I like, which is there is no amount of talent that's a substitute for just being a nice person to have around. And I think that's our job in this really tiny industry to sort of help each other out, you know, and be kind and look after each other and prop each other up rather than punching each other down here. Pushing rather than punching. Punching was a more, I guess, violent, yeah, image.
Oh my goodness, this conversation, Rory, thank you for chatting with me.
No,
this,
thank you,
been fun.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
Educational.
Yes, it's been,
I love learning.
Yeah, me too.
Where can we find you on the social web?
You can go to my, I guess the best thing, I'm trying with Instagram and Facebook and things, but it's not good. I would go to my website, which is, yeah, I'm very old school like that. I'd go www.rorydmcgregor.com. That's the best place to find me, I suppose.
Well, this conversation has been wide ranging, fascinating, educating. I appreciate you sharing your story. I think other people are going to really enjoy it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I want to think before I speak here. I have not had a theatrical director on. Well, I have, but not in the path that you've had.
Oh, I was going to say then, if
you
it's
know, I've had
me,
like people who've had like really significant acting careers, right, and then transitioned into directing, but I haven't had someone who's
I'm just
studied
from the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, you've really studied it, and this is what you know what you're doing.
I mean, that's what's mad is there you go, mad again. What's mad is that like I've been doing this now. I'm like, yeah, I've been doing it for 10 years, which is nuts because I don't know, like I still feel like, you know, you still feel like you're sort of beginning.
Yeah,
But yeah, no, it's been, hey, if it's only been me who's the only theater director you've had on, the bar is pretty low. I like that.
Shoot.
I like setting the bar. So then when you get the next ones on, like there's going to be a, you know, you can only go up from here with the.
Oh, you're too funny. Well, thanks, man. This is
English self-deprecation.
Exactly. Exactly. Is there anything else you want to add right before we wrap up here?
No, I think, I don't know. I think I rambled my way through my life. I don't know. I'd say if there are any theater directors listening who are starting out and are confused as what to do, I think, yeah, like really, really just going to see plays is really important. Reading plays and figuring out like what it is you want to do and who it is you want to work with and like the kind of venue, because, you know, it's hard. Like I don't think you can just blanket attack directing in a way like that you can with other professions, in that you have to be specific, I think, about like the kind of work you like and the kind of work eventually that once you've figured that out that you want to make, right? Like as I said, Stanley Kubrick was the reason I got into directing in the first place. And out of that, I got into theater directing because as I was transitioning to go to undergrad, a friend of mine was like, hey, if you like Kubrick, you should read these plays. And he sent me these in-your-face theater plays from Britain, you know, like writers like Sarah Kane, Philip Ridley, Mark Ravenhill. And I read them and I realized that people were doing on stage, the kind of things that I'd really enjoyed in movies. Mm. And that kind of is what set me off, you know, and, yeah. And just keeping at it because it can be difficult, you know? Yeah.
Be.
Yeah.
Well, very good, man. Thank you. Right. Thank you for sitting down with me here.
No, thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Rory McGregor.
You've been listening to Entertainment X, the podcast. You can follow Entertainment X on Instagram at @EntertainmentX_. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join Clay next week for another Curiosity Conversation on Entertainment X. Thank you for listening.